Such a blessing to be here and to engage together in worship that is uplifting to us all this morning. And I want to thank all of the men, particularly, who helped serve in the service. And, we don't have that many men right now. We are kind of short-handed at times, but I really appreciate whenever you step up and help lead the prayers and wait on the Lord's table, lead at the table, and you all do such a fantastic job. So I commend you, and I really appreciate what you do, and appreciate Matt's passion in his prayers, and Jeremy the relating of the Lord's Supper to that message that we all know someone who needs Jesus, and Jesus is there to meet the needs that in our world today that are so many troubling problems that people have in our lives, that Jesus is the answer. Jesus is the one who is able to help each one of us, and we need him in our lives. So thank you for those very uplifting messages. And Gene, our hearts go out to you with the loss of your brother-in-law, Don, this morning. Such a tragic thing to hear that news. So I want to invite you this morning again to the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 5. And I'm going to begin by reading several verses here in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. And we're going to be talking this morning about man's relationship to God. So the book of Ecclesiastes is sometimes described as the Philippians of the New Testament. It is a bright, shining message here that is in the wisdom of the Old Testament. And sometimes we think of Proverbs as the James of the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes is the Philippians of the Old Testament. So it's got a message here that many people can, once we understand what the message of Ecclesiastes just is so helpful and meaningful and in our lives today, it helps point us to the answer, which is Jesus Christ in our world that is so much needed. So let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. And he says this. He says, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. For they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God." The book of Ecclesiastes, and the writer here, Solomon, in the opening chapters here, lays out for us what it is like to live here on this earth without God. He describes this as living under the sun, and he is conducting here, he says, "I search for wisdom," as he look for meaning in life and the answers to life that are sometimes troubling or people searching for answers of the meaning of life. And so as he started out, he talks about life under the sun and saying that all is vanity and there is no profit under the sun. So he's describing here what it is like to live in the world and not know God, to just try to make sense of life here on this planet and not have be guided by the truth of God. And that is how many people do live life today, sadly. But his point is that life here on this earth is sometimes so full of questions that we cannot find the answer to life. And it leaves us hanging here just feeling almost depressed or helpless to solve the problems that life presents to us. But in chapter 3, he observed the fact that and learned that God has a design in all things that happen in our lives, that there is a design to it. There's a time for everything under heaven. There's a time to be born. There's a time to die. And a time for peace, a time for war. It just seems like there's a time there in life for everything. And there is one that is for this, and there's another that sort of balances it out on the other direction. And some positive, some negative, but life has a sense of meaning to it. There is a design to it as we really search into life and as it is here on earth. And we see in verse 11 that he said that God has set eternity in human hearts. That there is within us a feeling, and it almost seems like intuition, that there is something out here beyond this life. And that this life, which comes so shortly to an end for us here as we live it, but there is something beyond it that speaks of eternity. And that is in our hearts, that we have an innate sense to that, of knowing that the way that we have been created, there has to be more out here in the world than just what we are seeing here with our own eye. There's questions of who created the world and what is the purpose of it. It does show evidence of this. So I also pointed out that while there is a lot of injustice here on this earth, God will judge all men and he will provide justice eventually in his planning and in his time. God is going to right the wrongs that exist here on this earth that we are troubled by. Jeremy mentioned Larry King in an interview years ago and talking about that he just cannot believe in a God that allows so much evil and things to happen here on earth. But the writer of Ecclesiastes is pointing out the fact that God is going to judge every man. And in that, he will right these wrongs. He will provide the justice that the world seems to be lacking. In chapter 4, he went on to point out, though, that man cannot resolve the problems of life, the pressing issues of life, even the most troubling ones that we have, man, in our own ability, we are not able to resolve these. And whether that be on the individual level in your life personally, or as we work together in a society, we still cannot resolve these issues. And some of them are very simple, very basic issues like loneliness. That people work to acquire riches, and yet in doing so, they neglect to form healthy relationships in their life. And they end up being very sad and miserable people in spite of their efforts to work and make some kind of worthwhile contribution of their life, they end up being very lonely. And when it comes to in government, many times there is a young man that has the aspiration and he comes up to be the king. And yet, before we know it, the people are no longer popular with him and they want someone else. And there's a continual revolving of this going on. And nothing really gets resolved. So he's talking about these problems that exist in the world. But as he has begun to introduce the idea of God in our lives, to see that God desires to have a meaningful relationship with each one of us. The fact that God has a purpose in everything that we see, that we may not be able to quite fathom what that purpose is always, and yet the layout of life and the design that there is to it indicates that God is the creator and that he does all things perfectly. He is above the sun. We are here below the sun. And so is it possible, does the possibility exist that man can have a relationship with God? And that leads him now to the question that we are going to be considering in chapter 5. And as we think about God and his relationship with man, there are a couple of things that Solomon had said earlier in the book of Ecclesiastes that raises a sort of a question of, does God really care about us? Or does he have good intentions to us? Because in chapter 1 and verse 13, he said that I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. Well, does this mean then that the only thing God has to do with us in our life is that he has placed this grievous, burdensome task on us, that here we have to work and to survive here on earth, and he just put this burdensome thing upon us and goes off and he doesn't care about us anything after that? Well, he said in chapter 2 and in verse 24 through 26, he commented upon this once again. And he said, nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. He said, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. But again, does this indicate, is he saying here that the best thing that we can get out of this life is that we can learn to work and come home and be able to enjoy the fruit of our labor in that way, but is there no purpose beyond that? What about, can we have a relationship with God? And if there's going to be a judgment day that God is going to judge the righteous and the wicked, and he is going to bring about justice in that, doesn't that indicate to us that inevitably each one of us is going to have an encounter with the living God in our life? The fact that he even made that statement that God is going to judge the righteous and the wicked, isn't that telling us that eventually we are going to have to stand before God and have an answer, and we're going to have a meeting with God? So how can we prepare for that? Can we have a meaningful relationship with God? So in chapter 5, he begins to address that question for us here in Ecclesiastes. And so as he begins, the first thing that he points out is that we need to have a proper attitude when we do this. That a proper attitude in meeting with God is essential. And that we cannot approach this with a lackadaisical attitude. When we're talking about man having a relationship with God and meeting with God in some way, we need to have a proper attitude when we do this. So he said, walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. So we need to recognize who God is. That God is in heaven, we are here on earth. He is the Creator, He is the sovereign ruler of the universe, the Lord, our God, and we are His creatures and we are His subjects. So whenever we go to have a meeting with God, we need to have that firmly planted in our minds that He is God and we are His subjects. So that is, in other words, to say that we need to have a reverence attitude when we approach God in meeting with Him. And if that comes to going into the house of God to worship, we need to have this attitude as we prepare ourselves. I am going in to worship God today, and I need to have in my mind who is God and who am I, and I need to have a reverence about it when I go in. So he said, when you go to the house of God, walk prudently. Be careful when you go in there and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. Now, as we come in to worship God, the thing that needs to be in our mind is, I am coming to hear God speak to me. I am not coming in here just to fulfill a ritual duty of some sort. I am coming to hear what God has to say. And certainly that is the proper attitude that we need to have. And he says, do not go in to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. So the sacrifice of fools, sometimes many people have a casual, lackadaisical attitude that I can go in to worship God and I can give Him some kind of a gift or offering, and then I can go on my way and I can continue on living in my own chosen way of life, totally disregarding how God directs me how I ought to be living. So that would be the sacrifice of fools. And he is saying that, no, we need to prepare our minds and we need to come and to approach God in a way that we are reverent to Him and we are willing to listen to what God has to say to us. And that means that we're willing to be obedient to the will of God. That when I walk out from worshiping God, the thing that I am going to be committing myself is I am now going to be putting that into practice, and that is going to become the shaping of how I conduct myself in my day-to-day life. So that is the proper attitude that we should have. And he said, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. So it requires obedience on the part of God. And the tendency of fools is to utter rash words. When people come into the presence of God, sometimes the foolish behavior is to make promises to God. Sometimes, of course, people come in to worship God and they are going through some kind of a problem that they have in their life, a pressing problem, and they have the idea and the concept that I can go into God and I can make a promise to God and I can say, God, if you will take care of this problem that I'm having in my life, then I will do this, that, and the other for you. But once they walk out the door, they forget about that promise that they have made to God. Those are just hasty, rash words that they are saying. And they seem to have the notion that God is not smarter than that to figure out and see through what they're doing. That would be a foolish behavior. Now, we do not even do that with one another. We do not treat in our relationships with other people that we can go up to them and say, hey, you want? Here's something I will do for you if you will do this for me. And then we turn around and once they have done for us what we promised we would do, we totally forget about that. And we understand that people in our society, in our daily relationships with one another, can see through that easily. That we will not be able to get away with that because people will recognize the fact that we are acting like a fool. We are taking them for a fool. And we're not going to be able to continue doing that very long. And yet people try to do this with God. That is his point. That is offering the sacrifice of fools to not give credit to the fact that God, who is the Creator, has the wisdom to see what we are doing if we attempt to do something like that. That we do not come into worship God to hear Him speak to us, and we are willing to then take that to heart and say, there are things in my life that need to be changed, that I need to repent of the things that I am doing that are not pleasing in the eyes of God. I need to make those corrections. And yet the fool goes out the door and he forgets all about it. All that he was doing was engaging in an attempt to manipulate God into giving him what his wishes were, and he never had any intention of changing his life and doing what God, he knows, should know, would have him to do. So God, throughout his word, has always put the emphasis on, when you come to worship, it is God's word is going to be spoken, and you need to be listening to what God is saying, because we need to take God seriously if we are going to have a meaningful relationship with Him. Now the writer then is pointing out that the proper attitude that we need to have is one of reverence, and that the proper response that we need to have is one of obedience. So as he continues in verse 4, he talks about this problem of making hasty promises. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It's better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Now, of course, we find that in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 1 through 23, the law of Moses clearly stated this, that a vow, when it comes to vows, we are not under any obligation to make a vow to God. We're not commanded to make a vow. But if we make one, then we need to keep the vow. So we need to understand that anytime we're going to make a vow, there are the implications that come with that, that God is going to be watching to see and observing, do you keep your vows when you make a vow to God? So he's saying, do not come in to worship and make a rash vow, a rash promise. Now I have an example of that in the book of Acts, where Ananias and Sapphira, they sold a piece of property and they brought it into the apostles and presented that, and yet they had kept back part of that for themselves, and yet they made it appear that they were giving that money to the Lord. Well, we know what happened with Ananias and Sapphira, that the Holy Spirit discerned the fact of what they were lying to God, and one by one, they died before that day was over. It's a very serious matter to make a vow to God and not keep it. So we should not be making rash promises to God, because we need to have more reverence for God. It's disrespectful to God for us to come in to worship God and not be serious in our attempt that we are worshiping God, and we're going to listen to God speaking to us, and we're going to take that and we're going to seek in our life to try to be obedient to the will of God. So in verses 6 and 7, he said, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. Now he makes a proverb here that he compares these two things, that he says for in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is vanity. But fear God. Now, there, in making dreams, many times people dream all sorts of things. We dream about building this house, you know, someday. And yet it never happens. Well, many of times the dreams that we might, there's too much activity and actual work that would go into it. But we dream many things, and yet there's a huge difference between a dream and reality, what comes out of it. Well, that's the same way it is. He's saying that many people in their worship, they say one thing, but they don't do that. That's not what they end up doing at all. So there is a vanity in that. And he says here, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. When a person would make a commitment of a vow, they would do that in the presence of witnesses. They would do that in the presence of priests or other officials at the temple. That, Lord, I will bring an animal, the finest animal, and present it to you if you will grant my request that I am making. Well, sooner or later, if they did not fulfill that promise, then the messenger would be sent to collect that from the person. When the messenger would show up, then the person would say, oh, well, it was a mistake. I forgot all about that. I didn't realize. And so they would be embarrassed. They would have to make an excuse that they did not fulfill their promise that they had made. And here is the person coming from the priest and asking about it. You said that you were going to give this offering to God. And when are you going to do that? Well, it was a mistake. I can't do it. So he's saying, do not make those kind of promises that you cannot fulfill the promise, because then you're going to look like a fool. Point of the chapters here is to understand, when it comes to a relationship with God that we have, that God is in heaven. We are His creatures. And therefore, His desire is that we fear Him, we depend upon Him, and that we become obedient to His will. And we ought not think, like a fool would think, that we can somehow fool God into manipulating Him like we have Him on the end of a string. And we can make these promises to Him at will anytime we want, and then we can walk out and not fulfill them. That is the behavior of a fool. Do not let your worship devolve to that point that you have such a low concept of God that you do not enter into worship with proper reverence and a willingness to listen and practice what God's word is directing us to do. So he continues in verse 8, and he talks now about this problem of oppression and abuse and injustice that we do have in the world. And so he says, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Now, we see that he is telling us here then that we should not be surprised when we see injustice in our higher officials. That should not surprise us. Why? Because it's typical of human nature. This is what we would come to expect of man. That man, being put in a position of power and authority, will tend to abuse that power. They will tend to use that power for their own advantage and not for the advantage of the people who are under them. So if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness happening in a province, don't be surprised. Don't marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. In other words, they've got a good old boy network already set up. And the high official is set up over the next official below, and they have a racket that they are conducting in which now that they have the power, they are going to use it for their own selfish advantage. And they're all conspiring in it and working together. High official over high official over high official. You do the dirty work, we will cover for you, but we know what you have done, and if you ever turn tables, we will turn on you and throw you under the bus. So it is a system that is very hard to correct. It's very hard to correct and avoid and overcome this kind of corruption that we have in the higher levels of government. And make no mistake about it, we have this corruption in our own government today. That there is a deep state. There is a group of people who have the power, and they do not intend to release that power. They are covering for each other the crimes that they are committing against the people of our country and our society. And so there is oppression. There is injustice. Don't be surprised at that, he says. That's just how it is. That's how life works. That when a person gets into that position, it's a rare individual that will not fall into that same thing that is happening. Because how do they correct it? How can they correct it? If they try to correct it, they are going to be attacked. They're going to be accused. They're going to be taken to court. Because this setup is in place and they are covering for each other. And so therefore, how can we correct that? What can we do? Well, he says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. Now, this is how it should work. This is how government officials should, in a righteous situation, an official who has integrity, this is how they will approach. Because they will recognize that I am in a position of leadership because the people have put an entrustment into me, and yet the people are the ones who I serve. And they are valuable, and I'm going to do what is in the interests of the people who elected me to this office. He said, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. In other words, in an agricultural society like they had, the king is in a position of power, and yet he recognized that the produce that comes from the farms is what sustains our economy. And therefore, my responsibility as the king is to exercise righteousness and justice that we might serve the interests fairly and justly of the farmer who's out there working in the field. In other words, I need them and they need me to keep things law and order. And that is where we all have a place to play. And yet this is not a position for me, now that I am in this authority, to take abuse of over the people who are in this position, where if I did use the abuse, they couldn't do anything about it. They have no one to defend them. But I'm not going to abuse that authority because I am a man of integrity, and I'm going to serve in my office to the best of my ability to represent the people who put me here. So that is something that, unfortunately, we don't see happening near often enough. And yet, that is why there is corruption. That's why there is injustice. And we shouldn't really be surprised with it. The reality is that men use position to their own advantage. The way it should be is they value the people that are below them. Now let's talk about the downside of riches for the remainder of time that we have here in chapter 5. Because the abuse of riches and the desire for riches is what leads to materialism And that becomes the number one enemy of having a meaningful relationship with God. What he talked about earlier, that if we're going to have a meeting with God, we need to have reverence, we need to have a sincerity, we need to have a determination to know the will of God, to be obedient to the will of God. But the number one enemy of that is the desire for riches, that we can easily get caught up in, and that can take over the consuming part of our life and become the central focus that we set our eyes upon. So he says here a number of things that are like proverbs or principles, basic principles, that we need to be reminded of this, of why we should not set riches as the main focus of our lives. First of all, he said that greater riches do not bring greater satisfaction in a person's life. They do not do that. They do not fulfill the deeper satisfaction that we have. Now he said, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. So one of the problems with riches is that after you acquire riches, you still do not have satisfaction. You still always want to have more riches. That is the tendency that we see with acquiring riches. Now, sometimes it is true that people who are in a poverty situation, if they can acquire a certain level of riches, they can get themselves out of poverty. And then they can better their circumstances in that way. But it still remains true that once they reach that point, riches do not bring the lasting satisfaction in our life. In other words, they get out of poverty and they get up to a certain level. Now they have some means to no longer be in poverty. But from that point on, riches don't bring added satisfaction. Person will want to have more. They will become more obsessed with attaining that, and it eventually does not bring the satisfaction. Now, the second thing that he points out that is the more money that you have, the more worries that come with it. He says in verse 11 and 12, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Now, we might sometimes say today, too much of a good lifestyle. Look at all the problems that come with having the prosperity and the advantages. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Look at the person who won the lottery ticket. And now, all of a sudden, all of the cousins come out of the woodwork, right? And they now have so many friends that they are their long-lost cousin. And they wanted to come see them. They wondered how they're doing. So when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And so what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? In other words, there's a lot of worries and troubles that come when you have more wealth and you begin to have a lot more problems also with it. In some ways, the man who has just a very modest income may be happier than the person who has the riches. He says that the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. He goes to work every day. He comes home. He sleeps good at night. He feels good. He has a job. He does his job right. And so he comes home at night. He doesn't have a lot of worries on his mind. He just goes to sleep and has a good night's rest every night. But the other man who has the riches, who has all of these luxuries, now he's got so many worries running around inside of his mind. He can't get a good night's sleep, whether he eats little or much. And if he eats too much, then he has heartburn or some other, and his blood pressure goes up. And so there are a lot of problems that sometimes come with having riches. We need to consider that before we make that the absolute purpose of our life. Next, we can't take it with you. And we all know that. That is another proverb that is very familiar. He said, "There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand." So sometimes riches can be quickly won, but they can also be quickly lost. If you're playing the stock market, or if you are investing and the economy crashes, think of all the people that lost hundreds of thousands of dollars overnight when the stock market went down. Well, these types of things do happen in life. And at the end of the day, you can't take it with you. That's what he's telling us. And he is also saying here that those who live high die hard. Verse 16 and 17, he said, "This also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger." So a person who is so committed to driven to acquire wealth and to acquire riches, and he just works so hard on this all of the time to gain that advantage that he is hoping for in life. But you look at his life, and his life is darkness. He doesn't really have any enjoyment and joy and satisfaction. He hasn't found that. It didn't come with that quest that he had to make all of those riches. So what is the best way, again, to approach life that the wise man here is sharing with us? And keep in mind that if there was anyone who would be in a position to know if riches can satisfy, it would be Solomon. Solomon was the richest man in the world. He also had the wisdom that God gave him. And he said it does not bring that satisfaction that people think it will. But he closes with three pieces of enjoyment, or three pieces of wisdom that we can take away. And that is, in the first place, he says that God gives true enjoyment. "Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage." So there's a way that we can live life, and we can live it with recognizing God is the one that is the creator that we serve, that we answer to, and to eat and drink and enjoy the good of your labor in which he toils under the sun, which God gives him. It is his heritage. In other words, if we can learn to live in the blessings that we have instead of fretting over the ones we don't have, then we're going to be a whole lot better off. We'll be able to enjoy life. We'll be able to have a sense of contentment that comes with you're able to work, you're able to enjoy the fruit of your work, you have relationships in your life, you have God in your life. This is so much a better way to approach your life. Secondly, God enables the fulfillment in your work. To understand that, in verse 19, "As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God." So God, recognize that God is the one that enables us to enjoy your life And he has promised to provide for us if we seek first his kingdom. And therefore, we can have contentment. We can have satisfaction. We can see this is the gift of God. God gives me another day here to enjoy. I'm going to enjoy this day, rejoice in it. And the labor and the blessings that God has given me, I'm so thankful for those things. And finally, he says that God provides general contentment in your life. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. So instead of fretting over the things, the days of his life, he doesn't dwell unduly on that. You know, how can I make more money? How can I raise myself up into, I want more. I need more. I need to continue striving to have more silver and more gold here on this earth. And there's no enjoyment of life. But he said, God keeps you busy with the joy of his heart. God will give us things to do to enjoy each and every day. And we can learn to be able to look at our life that life has got its share of problems, no question about it. Life is difficult, but God is good. And God is with us. God is blessing us. And therefore, we can enjoy life. We can see it as the gift of God. And we can see that there's a purpose in life to have moderation and contentment and have people in our lives and have place for God in our life. This is the way that we should approach life. And when it comes to approaching God and having a relationship with God, once again, it is you go in to listen to God's word. What God has to say is God speaking to us in his word. And he gives us a way of life to live that we take his word, we apply it in our life, and then we find this enjoyment and this, we find salvation. That God has his purpose and his plan that we might spend eternity with him in heaven, even when this life is over. Thank you for your attention this morning, and we're going to close by singing the song of invitation that has been selected. And if you're subject in any way this morning to the Lord's invitation, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.
Have thine affections been nailed to the cross?